University of Illinois Law School faculty and staff have joined students in speaking out against one of their professors involved in a sexual harassment investigation. Here's Illinois Student Bar Association President Ashley Kennedy.
He is the head of the cybersecurity certificate program within the law school. So how are students who are in this program or who are wanting to pursue this program able to do so without contact with him? You know, those are some major concerns that have not really been addressed.
Plus, a new study finds that many animal veterinarians struggle with ethical conflicts over what pet owners ask of them. But first, have you ever felt like this when traveling?
There's no room for your feet. You can't put your feet nowhere. You're like not pigeon-toed, but you're facing like duck feet sideways, and that hurts your ankles at the same time while you're sitting down.
That's passenger Jose Maldonado on All Things Considered. NPR's David Shaper joins us to talk fuel prices, new FAA regulations, and whether or not you'll have any more room for your feet traveling this holiday season. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up later this hour, University of Illinois law faculty and students are speaking out against Professor Jay Kaysen following a university sexual harassment investigation. They say the university's policies aren't working. But first, the busy fall travel season is soon to be upon us. But with fuel prices up, American Airlines just changing its rebooking rules, and will cramped seats on airlines ever change? NPR's David Shaper has been reporting on that as well as other transportation news. He's back with us now to talk about this. Hey, David, welcome back to the 21st.
Well, thanks for having me. How are you, Nyla?
I'm good because I haven't flown in the past 2 weeks. I feel like I've been on a lot of planes. So here's, look, you know, David, I'm barely 5'2", and I can't handle cramped seats. So, but Congress changed the law on this recently, right? Will it matter?
Well, that remains to be seen. Congress, as part of this big FAA reauthorization bill, a law that allows the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, to operate and to, you know, run air traffic control and all kinds of other things, there was a little provision stuck in there on behalf of consumers that Congress is telling the FAA, you need to set minimum standards for seats. Minimum dimensions for the width of the seat, for the amount of legroom, which they call pitch, which is basically the distance from one spot on your seat to the same spot on the seat in front of you. That has shrunk to as little as 28 inches on some airlines, primarily the low-cost discount airlines like Spirit and Frontier and a few others. But even on the regular, you know, United and American and Delta, they've gone as low as 30 or 31, depending on the airline, depending on the type of plane it is. And, you know, I'm not that big either. I'm about 5'7", and my knees are up against the seat in front of me oftentimes when I'm sitting in economy class. I talked to a bunch of people who are quite a bit taller, talking to them about their flight experiences, and one guy was telling me how, you know, it's not even that he has no leg room. He has nowhere to put his feet. Like, he's got to put his feet, like, duck feet, you know, sticking out in both directions.
Yeah, we played that actually at the beginning of the hour, that from that gentleman you spoke with.
Yeah, so it's a crazy situation. So Congress finally comes in and says, all right, enough of this, shrinking airline seat, FAA set minimum standards. But it doesn't tell them what the standards should be. So the regulators could take a look at the atmosphere and the what the airlines are doing and say, you know, where it is now is fine. And they're doing this on a safety basis. They can't really regulate airline seats just strictly based on comfort. And so the measure that they use is, can a plane be evacuated within 90 seconds in an emergency? And they've done some drills and they've done some tests with this. I've done some reporting on this in the past. They do simulations and that sort of thing. And they found that people can get up out of their seats, even when they're this small, and exit a plane in a expeditious manner, and that the narrowness of these rows and the tightness of the legroom is not hindering our ability to evacuate a plane. So the FAA could just come in and say our minimum standards are going to be what they are now, or they could even make them smaller. They're not going to necessarily give us more legroom.
And there's also a new law that will prohibit airlines from removing passengers from overbooked planes after they boarded. David, this is after the United Airlines incident in Chicago. Was it last summer or the summer before?
It was in April of 2017, so about a year and a half ago. And that was Dr. David Dow on a flight that was heading from Chicago's O'Hare Airport to Louisville, I believe. The plane was overbooked. Actually, they needed to put crew members on that plane so that they could be there and ready to go to run a flight from Louisville to, I think, New York the next day. And so they asked for volunteers. Nobody got off the plane. They randomly chose four people. One of them was this Dr. David Dow, who refused. And so the
that's when he got punched.
The airline representatives called O'Hare security officers. They were not police officers. And they dragged him off the plane, roughed him up pretty bad. There were hearings in Congress. Everybody was in an outrage. The video of this went viral worldwide. United took a beating in a way because of this in terms of their image. And so Congress is saying no more. Once you put somebody on a plane, you can't remove them. The thing is that the airlines have, ever since that incident, done a much better job of trying to figure out, you know, when a plane is full, when it's over full. They have much more they have just better analytics and better data to know when a flight might be overbooked and are preventing themselves from overbooking, which they just used to do on a routine basis and then eat the cost of whatever the voucher is that they give somebody who volunteers to give up their seat. They have upped the amount of money that they give passengers who volunteer. So that's helping also with the overbooking situation. But it is probably a good idea that there is some regulation that once you're actually seated on the plane, you don't have to get up involuntarily and get off that plane.
We're speaking with NPR's David Schaefer. David, American Airlines also recently reduced options for travelers whose flights are delayed or canceled. This is a new rebooking policy they have?
Yeah, so oftentimes when a flight is delayed or canceled, particularly in the situation where it's delayed and it's a lengthy delay, airlines in the past have said, okay, well, you know, I'm flying on American. I'm going from Chicago to New York. United has a flight. It's not booked, fully booked. There are seats available. We'll just rebook you on that flight. And the airlines are saying, you know, we're not going to be so quick to do that anymore.
Quick to do it to begin with.
Not that they were. No, I think I had it happen to me once.
I think I've had it happen to me once, too. Yeah.
And I can remember actually being on an American flight. Our flight was delayed, and they did is offer to rebook us through other cities and lengthen the amount of time it would take us to our destination. And it was kind of, you know, like, seriously, so now I have to go to Philadelphia and then to Miami and then I go to, you know, wherever I'm going. It just seemed crazy. I mean, they don't want to give a lot of business away, obviously. So the thing of it is, for their most valued customers, those who are frequent flyers, who have the highest status on the airline, they will still offer to rebook you on a different airline. But they're going to really, and this isn't just American. American is taking some heat for announcing this policy. Quietly, United has already done this, and they're
so
just
this is pretty much going to be an industry standard. It seems like now
it sounds like it will mm-hmm. be. I think you could probably make some noise if it's particularly a delay that is caused by the airline and their problem. For example, if there's a maintenance issue, or if they just can't get the plane to your airport on time, and therefore they're just waiting for the plane to come from somewhere else, and it's a problem that's caused by them, I think you could probably make some noise and say, hey, listen, I really need to be in this place at a certain time. I know, like, for weddings and funerals and things like that, family emergencies, they will make an exception. But they're just not going to offer that unprompted at all.
Anymore. Right. And I think if you explain to them. One last question for you, David.
Sure.
I just want to ask you about fuel prices, because we're at highest seasonally since 2014. Do you think, are we at a point where this might affect airline ticket prices yet? Or what are we thinking about for the holidays?
It seems from just the little bit of research I've done that fares for this holiday season are up a bit over last year already. The capacity is tight. There's a lot of people flying. There's a lot of demand for flying. And so therefore the ticket prices seem to be a bit higher already.
Even for Thanksgiving, it's almost too late, isn't it?
It's getting, you know, they say, you know, if you can book by mid-October, that's the best. But usually by the end of October, you know, if you're going to fly on the day before Thanksgiving or the Tuesday before Thanksgiving and come back on that Sunday, you're going to be paying a lot regardless. no matter when you book. But yeah, we might start seeing fuel surcharges on some airlines. I know that a couple of foreign carriers have already started adding fuel surcharges. I don't think it'll be long before you see some of the airlines in the States do the same thing. If they don't outright raise fares, we'll see probably, you know, $10 here, $20 there. But, you know, airfares are going up and down all the time, depending on when you look, where you want to go, when you're trying to fly. I think a lot of people actually get frustrated by just the amount of variance. You know, you look right now and I'm going to be booking this trip in January. Here's what the prices are. And then you come back, you know, two or three days later and you look at the same flights and, oh, my gosh, they're a little more expensive. And then you look next week, oh, they're a little cheaper. You know, the supply and demand is always changing. The pricing of the airlines, it's one of the only industries, I can't think of any other industry where prices are changing on a constant basis.
Yeah, there's no rhyme or reason to them, right? So
well, there is. It's based on demand, and they have algorithms that'll know. They know that you on your computer are checking these airfares on a regular basis, so they're going to move them up because
you have long confirmed a suspicion that my mother has, David Shaper, about her IP addresses and looking for.
Right, and they're going to scare you into buying that ticket right now because, oh my gosh, the prices are going up. So. It's just kind of one of those things that people are starting to learn to live with. They're trying to use outdoor or outside sites to see what the fares are before they finally book. But it's still a game. It takes a lot
of time. And something that's just going to require a lot of time and research. All right. But
thanks for giving us a little bit of
information on how to handle that. That's NPR's David Shaper. Thanks, David.
Happy travels.
Students, faculty, and staff at the University of Illinois' College of Law in Champaign-Urbana are speaking out about a sexual harassment investigation involving one of its tenured professors, Jay Kaysen. In 2015, the campus launched an investigation into allegations of sexual harassment against Kaysen after multiple women came forward to complain about his interactions with female faculty members and students. Ultimately, 38 people told investigators they also experienced or observed troubling behavior involving Kaysen. Kaysen has denied the allegations. I should say that as a law professor at the university, he was once a guest on the 21st, and he was a frequent commenter for our home station, WILL's Legal Issues in the News. WILL has made a decision since the report came out to remove him as a legal commentator. And in a few minutes, we're going to be joined by U of I law faculty and students who are speaking out about this. But first, I'm joined by Christine Herman, a reporter at Illinois Public Media. She broke the story about all of this when she obtained the campus documents about this investigation through an open records request. And a note to our audience, we are going to be talking in detail about the sexual misconduct here, especially for the next 4 or 5 minutes or so. Christine, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Nyla.
First, can you tell us what campus investigators found? This investigation was actually, even though we just found out about this, this happened a couple of years ago.
Yeah, in 2015, there were three women who came forward and to speak with investigators. They said Kaysen allegedly did things like speak with him about his sex life and views on adultery, asked them about their sex lives, made a reference to masturbation. One of the witnesses, a former student, said Kaysen rubbed her thigh during a meeting in his office. And as you mentioned, there were 38 other people with corroborating testimony.
And we did invite Professor Kaysen to speak about this issue with us today. Christine, you've reached out to him during the course of your reporting multiple times. What has he said about this?
So he did not respond to requests for comment directly, but he sent a statement through a U of I spokesperson saying that he's sorry. He never intended to offend anyone. He did tell investigators, it's written in the report, that the accusations are, quote, without merit or they lack appropriate context.
And what did the investigators conclude?
So they determined that Kaysen violated the University of Illinois' campus code of conduct, and they said his actions were highly inappropriate and that he knew or should have known that they would make people feel uncomfortable. But they determined his actions did not meet U of I's high standards for what would constitute a violation of sexual misconduct policies.
Who are these investigators? This is the University of Illinois. This is the law school.
This is the Office of Diversity, Equity, and Access. So they were called in by then Dean of the College of Law in 2015.
So they were outside investigators. Well, outside.
They were campus investigators outside of the College of Law.
And so did anything happen to Professor Kaysen after this investigation? Was there disciplinary action taken against him?
So he was required to take in-person sexual harassment training. He was excluded from certain salary programs and lucrative endowment positions for a limited time, assuming no further misconduct. This is all written in a letter from College of Law Dean Vic Amar to investigators about how they were responding. And Dean Amar said in that letter they would take more serious action against him, even loss of tenure or employment, if he commits further violations.
And now this has all just come out. So this actually happened. The report actually even came out last year. How did we just find out about this last week?
There was a friend of some of the witnesses spoke up at a Me Too in Academia panel discussion last week at the College of Law and said, there's a report. It shows this. And she asked why the College of Law hasn't done more to protect students from sexual harassment. So I submitted a Freedom of Information Act request to obtain those documents that were actually, you know, that report was September 2017 when it was published. And then I did a story about it. And since then, there's been all this reaction, as you mentioned, from faculty, students, and staff, an ongoing discussion about what's going to happen.
Including a town hall tonight. Christine, we just about to take a break, but what has the university said about all this?
The University of Illinois spokeswoman, Robin Kaler, in a statement said the U of I took swift action to make sure no further violations would occur. Since the investigation was made public, they've made accommodations for students in Professor Kaysen's classes, including a separate section for his patent law class. She says so far three students have switched into it.
Okay. Well, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation. I do want to ask you if more people have come forward. So when we come back, we're going to continue talking with Christine, and we're also going to be joined by University of Illinois Law School faculty, a professor, and a student with the Student Bar Association. Stay tuned to the 21st.
Support for the 21st comes from University of Illinois Press, publishers of New Media Futures, The Rise of Women in the Digital Arts. A symposium featuring these trailblazing women will take place on Friday, October 26th at NCSA. The University of Illinois Press, celebrating 100 years.
Tuning into the 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. Tonight on the U of I campus, there will be a town hall meeting at the College of Law to directly address its response to a campus sexual harassment investigation we just learned about last week involving Professor Jay Kaysen. This town hall, by the way, is open to the community. The U of I is, of course, the state's largest public university, and students and faculty at the law school have been saying the university needs to change how they handle these types of investigations. Landon Webster is a law student and representative with the U of I Student Bar Association. And Paul Heald is with us as well, a law professor at the U of I. Paul and 47 other law faculty and staff released a letter yesterday saying not just that this entire process needs to be overhauled, but that they feel Kaysen, quote, betrayed the culture of community and respect at the law school. Landon, Paul, welcome to the 21st. Thank you for being here to talk about this. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
Landon, as we were just hearing from WILO reporter Christine Herman, all of this news broke last week. I just want to ask what the climate has been like in the law school since the news of this report came out.
I would say, by and large, it's been a pretty draining and emotional experience. I think everyone in the room at the panel where the news broke was pretty stunned. And then, you know, for a day or so until we had more detail as far as what the report included, we were sort of waiting for the other shoe to drop. And then once it did, we were pretty disappointed in the way that the administration had handled it.
I want to get into that a minute, but Paul, I want to ask you from, not that I'm asking you to speak on behalf of all faculty, but just from your perspective as one of the professors in the school, how did you react?
Well, I was basically appalled when I read the report. One of my colleagues had sat me down and explained what her experience was. Two of the three actual complainants were my colleagues, so you know we're feeling this pretty deeply too. Although we're probably more able to ride out the storm than the students are. I think they're feeling it more. In any event, I read the report finally, and I guess my reaction was I read all the facts as found by the investigator and by the ODEA, and then you get to the punchline, here are the sanctions, and there was such a complete disconnect between my horror at the facts I was reading and then what basically amounts to a slap on the wrist.
Hmm. And so I wanted to ask Landon and Paul, both of you, before we get to what you think the university should do, Landon, can you just explain to us, I think for people who haven't been in law school, what is the relationship like between students and professors? How big are the classes, for example, that you're in? Are they big classes? Are they small classes?
I mean, that can really range. Some classes would have as many as probably close to 100 people in a section. But, I mean, there are classes that are as small as 5 or 6 people. So I'm not sure about the specifics as to Professor Kaysen's classes. I think those tend to be smaller. And also one other concern we've had is that I know he teaches at least some night classes when the building is less populated and there could be greater concern. So, yeah, I mean, the dynamic as far as class size is, it can really change.
Right. And then also, I wonder, Paul, you have taken over one of the sections that Christine was mentioning, that one of the university's responses has been to, as Professor Kaysen continues to teach, to offer alternate sections of classes?
Right, yes, I'll be teaching an alternate section of patent law, and any students who want to move over to my section can feel free to do that.
And so what would you, Landon, let me ask you, first of all, what you would like to see happen here?
Well, first and foremost, the Student Bar Association, as a representative of the student body itself, has asked Professor Kaysen to resign. We think that that's entirely appropriate at this point. Then I think our greater concern after that point, after that initial issue is handled, is transparency. And that means both going forward and in hindsight, because I think it's objectively clear to anyone who reads the report that the facts substantiate a pattern in practice that was unacceptable. And I think, like Professor Heald said, I don't see how we can make that jibe with the punishment. So if the university is going to say that there are limitations on the transparency or the action that they could take, then we want to know what those specific limitations were so we can address them.
That's Landon Webster. He's a member of the U of I Student Bar Association. U of I law professor Paul Heald is in studio with us as well, along with reporter Christine Herman. That letter, all of these documents we've been talking about, the report, that letter yesterday that was signed by, my understanding, all but a handful of the law faculty, all of the administration, including Dean Vic Amara and the assistant deans, signed this letter, Paul. We've got that up at our website at 21stshow.org for those of you who are looking for more information on this. Paul, you said in the letter, and Landon has talked about this as well, the need to overhaul University of Illinois' sexual misconduct policies. They need to be revised. What do you think needs to happen?
Well, for one thing, the process has to happen a lot more quickly. That initial complaint was filed 3 years ago now, and this is only now coming out. It's unclear, since I'm not an expert in every single rule and regulation, it's unclear sort of where things went wrong, whether it was the investigators at the ODEA, whether it's rules and procedures and regulations in place from that office, or whether everybody's constrained by the adoption of the really strict Title VII sexual harassment standard as the burden of proof that a unit has to bear when it's trying to report this kind of misconduct. So there needs to be obviously a really close look, sort of from beginning to end, at the process in this case, hopefully leading to reform that will make responses much more quick and sanctions much more appropriate.
Christine, what has the university said in response to, and I should note to our audience, we did invite the university representatives from the university to join our conversation today as well. What have they said in response to the letter that was sent yesterday, Christine?
They said that they have reached out to the U of I Senate and will consider reviewing some of those policies, and they say they're committed to doing better going forward. So that's what a U of I spokesperson, Robin Kaler, said in a statement yesterday.
And Paul, you mentioned you're not an expert. I wanted to bring someone into this conversation who is. Laura Beth Nielsen studies sexual harassment in the workplace. She is a professor of legal studies at Northwestern University, and she's on the line from Evanston now. Hi, Laura. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us as well.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Laura, you've been listening to this whole conversation, and I wonder if you can just start by answering, is this a type of thing common for universities that a professor can be found in violation of campus policies? I think the actual wording of the report was they found that he violated the code of conduct. They found that he violated the, quote, spirit of the sexual harassment policies, but not the actual policy. Is this a common thing to happen?
Well, as I was listening, I was thinking, what a tragically familiar story, right? You have dozens and dozens of women over many years whose education has been compromised on the basis of their sex, or whose employment opportunities have been compromised on the basis of their sex by this person. That said, these are really hard conflicts for universities, especially public universities, especially with tenured professors, to navigate. The questions of proof, as one of your other guests was saying, are very complicated. So what would a woman need to show? And of course, you can be sexually harassed as a man. I'm going to use the familiar pronouns just to make this easier to follow. But what would a woman need to show in order to file a Title VII lawsuit is not necessarily the same thing that is required for a termination decision about a man who's doing the sexual harassing.
What is Title VII? A couple people have mentioned this. Oh, there's sure. Title VII, and then also Title IX laws come into effect here too, right?
Right. So Title VII protects your right to non-discrimination in the workplace on the basis of sex, among other things, right? There's also race and so on. And Title IX protects your right to an education free from sexual discrimination. So the students might have a Title IX claim, and his fellow faculty members or subordinates, if they're involved, would have a Title VII claim. So they're just the laws that prevent this kind of sexual harassment for these two groups of people. It gets complicated because, of course, in a university, there are people working there, there are people living there, there are people studying there, and all of those different groups are covered by different kinds of laws.
And I wonder, do you think this is different, Laura, because it's the University of Illinois is a state institution, and then therefore there are different state laws? Technically, as myself, I should disclose to our audience if you're not clear, I am a member, I'm a state employee as a member of the university because we have our station located here at the university. Is it different then as a state employee versus a private university like Northwestern? Are there different standards?
Well, you have the same kind of issues, and both institutions are governed also by state privacy and employment laws, right? So employers, including universities, are obligated to take care to protect employee privacy. So one of the things that often comes up is, well, you know, we can't warn, or that will be said is, we can't warn the campus community that this person, you know, is a sexual harasser because, well, first of all, there's defamation issues. Of course, the truth is always a defense. But in addition, employers are required to protect the privacy of their employees.
But what about after an investigation is complete, Laura? Because I wonder, like, in this case, the investigation was completed, and then our reporter here found out about it because of a FOIA request. So then it is public record. Does that
right.
have to happen every time?
Right now it does. And these are the kinds of sets of laws, right? It's not sort of one law that's governing this and creating this. You know, you hear about this all the time, that there were dozens of women, right? And so what needs to happen is we need to be looking at this set of laws that create different kinds of incentives to keep these things secret and hidden. And of course the university doesn't want the bad publicity, and they don't want the lawsuit from whoever might be terminated. And that's why people who are targets of this kind of thing need to be equally forceful about, we are going to have, you know, we're going to file our own lawsuits. We're going to take this into our own hands. I would like to see all of the women who this person sexually harassed after the university first knew about it. What kind of, you know, what kind of obligation do we owe to them once the university knows? And so I think we really need to be looking at these different sets of laws that have really conflicting, put universities and employers in really difficult places, but we need to put the protection of our students first. If someone is harassing students, they need to be out of the classroom immediately. And it often takes years.
That's Laura Beth Nielsen, who's speaking to us from Northwestern University. In studio with me here in Urbana is law student Landon Webster and law professor at the University of Illinois, Paul Heald. Landon, to the point about students, I imagine that's something the U of I Student Bar Association has been very vocal about. You think students have a right to know about this?
Absolutely. And we understand that there are confidentiality concerns that may prevent some information from being disclosed. That's sort of in this context why we're asking now that we know after the fact, after the FOIA, what those concerns are so that we can address them, because clearly they are not serving the public interest in this context. And when policies fail us, we need to be able to change those policies to prevent them from doing so in the future.
Laura, I think part of the whole Me Too movement is looking at systemic changes that are needed to combat sexual harassment, especially when we're talking about the workplace. And I wonder if this case is an example of that, as we've been hearing. And I wanted to just ask you if you have ideas for how this change can happen, because it is very complex. We've talked about a lot of different competing concerns that are very real here in terms of having due process and protection and privacy. But most of all, as you've said, creating a safe environment for students. How does the university go about handling this? Do there need to be changes to federal law?
One thing universities could say is we're not going to keep confidential these findings. If it results in someone being, if it results in a professor being disciplined, that's not going to be confidential. We're not going to keep that confidential anymore. And letting the campus community know, an incident happened here at Northwestern where, in a very similar way, it came out much later about a punishment, and there were undergraduates in a classroom with this professor at that time. And that just can't happen, right? It's too disruptive to the learning. When you feel threatened, you can't learn. We have to make sure these are safe environments. So universities can say, we're no longer going to keep these settlements confidential. For when we have to settle with a victim, we're going to let people know that we've done that. Cities and counties could also do that. They're talking about doing that in U.S. Congress. And in a way, all taxpayers have an incentive to push for that kind of policy, because this is our tax dollars being used to settle sexual harassment lawsuits while people continue to be employed. We should have a say in that. There should not be these kinds of confidentiality concerns once a finding has been made.
Right. And I see, thanks for that, Laura. And Paul, I see you nodding your head saying that, Landon, both of you agreeing that this confidentiality needs to change. We just have a minute left here. So just as we wrap up, Christine, I just want to ask you, since this report has come out, have more people come forward?
My understanding is more people may have come forward with sexual harassment allegations. The U of I spokesperson Robin Kaler said she couldn't confirm or deny that, but because if there is a pending investigation, they need to protect the integrity of those and the privacy of those involved. But this is a story I'll be continuing to report on. If people are wanting to come forward, they can reach out to me directly. And as a reporter, it's my job to keep those stories confidential.
So that's Christine Herman continuing to follow the story for WILL. Again, that town hall meeting will be this evening at 6 o'clock at the College of Law. I want to thank Landon Webster, a student representative and member of the U of I Student Bar Association and law professor at the University of Illinois, Paul Heald, for being with me as well. Thanks also to Laura Beth Nielsen from Northwestern. Thanks, guys.
The 21st is made possible in part by Krannert Art Museum at the University of Illinois, presenting a CAM Chamber Music Series concert by the Jupiter String Quartet, Saturday, October 27th at 2 p.m. More information is available at kam.illinois.edu.
You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. When it comes to our pets, many of us often think of these animals as members of our families. So when they get sick, we take them to the vet, hoping to get good news from trusted professionals. But a new study published in the Journal of Veterinary Internal Medicine finds that most vets experience ethical dilemmas when it comes to bad news and sometimes what pet owners ask of them. The study finds that almost 70% of vets said they felt moderate to severe distress about not being able to give animals proper care, and almost two-thirds were bothered by inappropriate requests to put animals down. Dr. Lisa Moses is the lead author of that study. She's a veterinarian at the Massachusetts Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. She's also a bioethicist at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Moses, thanks for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for your interest in this work.
And here in studio with me in Urbana is Kate Hamilton. Kate is a licensed clinical therapist and a social worker at the University of Illinois College of Veterinary Medicine. Kate, thanks for being here as well.
Well, thank you.
Dr. Moses, I wondered if you can just explain a little bit about in your study, you said vets were dealing with something called moral distress. Can you define what that means, what that is for us?
Sure. Moral distress is the feelings and the distress that's produced when an individual is in a situation where they know what the right thing is to do, but for a variety of reasons, it's nearly impossible to do that right thing. And what we're really talking about is not just the idea that veterinarians are put in this position of conflict, but that they have negative feelings associated with that conflict.
And so when we're saying being put in situations, does this primarily come down to people asking to put animals to sleep, even though a lot of veterinarians, maybe from the vet's opinion, that's not medically necessary?
That's the situation lots of times, but unfortunately, reality of veterinary medicine is that there's lots of other situations that we face on a daily basis that also cause the feelings of moral distress. For example, veterinary medicine is quite technologically advanced these days, and nearly as often, depending upon where you practice, as being asked to euthanize an animal that you feel like you can help, we might be in the situation where we're asked to continue providing medical care when we think that the animal is suffering needlessly.
So it's kind of both ways, both sides of this situation, right? Maybe when an animal is suffering and the vet can see from a medical perspective that things are not going to get better, but then there's also the other side of it. That sounds really tough.
It is really tough. And, you know, there's a whole bunch of stuff that happens between those two extremes, and also not about euthanasia. There's so many decisions that pet owners and veterinary professionals have to make whenever they're figuring out what's the right thing to do for animals. So there's lots of situations that we face that bring this up.
I want to get into some of those situations in a minute, but Kate, I wanted to ask you, mental health issues among the veterinary community is something that we've seen some news reports about, and we know that veterans actually die by suicide at a rate four times the general population, and twice of those in the medical profession, according to the CDC, that's for veterinarians. I wonder how you think the vet community is changing the way they train and prepare veterinarians for all of this, because that, I wonder, just equipping people on the training side is important.
Yes, and that is exactly what I do at the vet school in Illinois. So my focus is bringing in that wellness and bringing in coping skills and training on better ways for them to care for themselves. So I do different communication skills workshops. I do one-on-one counseling to help with some of those moral distress moments. But the big thing that I try to focus on is letting the students know that they have a voice and they have resources and to reach out for help. So I at the vet school, there's 500 vet students. So I also do a lot of counseling referrals and trying to connect vet students early on in their career with counselors so they know they can find a safe place.
Kate, I wanted to ask you, and then Dr. Moses, I'd love to have you weigh in. When we're thinking about these moral distress situations, how much of this is also, as you said, you mentioned you do communication skills. How much of this is maybe having vets properly prepared to communicate with people about the situation they're facing with their animals, and if that can even prevent these situations from happening in the first place? Is that a focus?
Yes. So at Illinois Vet School, the students have clinical rotations every year. And so I'm about to start on Thursday with the first years doing communication skills, role playing, and practicing that grief sharing. And then afterwards, talking about it, talking about ethical dilemmas, the things, emotions that come up, some suggestions with empathy statements, and overall conflict management skills. So we try to, at Illinois, do that every year to kind of build up that stamina.
Dr. Moses, what about that in terms of giving vets the tools ahead of time to be able to communicate with people about the situation they're in? Do you feel like that's happening across the board?
Well, I think Kate's absolutely right that better training in communication, some skills in conflict resolution, and absolutely empathy training are really, really essential. And what was really interesting in my research is that although, you know, we did a survey of vet school curriculums, and now the majority of vet school curriculums are actually including some training in communication. They are including training in ethics. But that's just the current generation of students. And there's a lot of veterinarians out there who unfortunately didn't get those kinds of training and don't have the tools that they need to navigate this. One welcome thing that I have seen happening is a tiny, burgeoning, but growing interest in the idea of marrying social work in veterinary medicine, and the whole field of veterinary social work is really starting to take off. So we're seeing more and more
People like Kate, it sounds like, yeah.
People like Kate, and in actual, not just in veterinary schools these days, even in private hospitals now, programs in veterinary social work are being put in place. And, you know, that helps in two ways. It helps the veterinarians because it can provide direct support to them, but also having a resource that you can direct a client to so that the veterinarian doesn't bear the burden of having to do that work with a client besides the medical care is really, really helpful.
We're speaking with Dr. Lisa Moses about a study that she did. She's joining us from Massachusetts, where she is a bioethicist at Harvard Medical School and a vet with the Massachusetts Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. In studio with me here in Urbana is Kate Hamilton. And we've been talking about the work Kate does as a licensed clinical therapist and social worker at U of I's College of Vet Medicine. So, Kate, I wanted to also ask you, we've been talking about the mental health side of this, but there's another effect of all of this, and it's something called decision fatigue, where not only are vets having to make all of these moral decisions in their job, that actually makes your brain even more tired, right? So I wonder if it makes it harder for medical professionals to make decisions in their own lives as well.
Yes, and that's something, again, I talk with the vet students, is the amount of decisions they have to make in the day. And some of them are related to ethical issues, but there's also decisions every moment that they're making with treatment. So it's being self-aware throughout the day on if they need a coping skill, if they need a transition, a ritual when they get home so they're able to make decisions in their personal life. Because what we are finding is they're struggling with those personal decisions. They're able to, during the job, make decisions. But when they come home, they're just exhausted and burnt out.
Because they spend all their energy on their work. Sure.
Exactly.
Dr. Moses, the other thing we haven't talked about is just the cost of care. And I wonder how often that's an issue when it comes to these decisions as well, how much the cost of care is when it comes to pets.
I think that's a really ever-present and huge looming issue. One of the things that I found in the research, a lot of veterinarians who answered the questions in the survey mentioned that this whole business of the financial reality of the cost of care and how much that limits what we do is just really the way it is, and there's nothing they can do about it. And of course that's true, but the other flip side of that is that when this study came out and I started hearing from members of the public about it, I realized that veterinarians are often the target of intense anger and frustration from pet owners who are people who are so saddened and frustrated because they cannot deal with the financial costs of care. What I really want the public to know about that is that veterinarians know that. You know, we understand. Most of us are not getting rich off of this. In fact, I don't know any veterinarians who's getting rich. We get it, and we really want to work with pet owners to be able to figure out what is in the best interest of the animal that we both care for. So one of the things that I really want to address, and I'd love to hear what Kate has to say about this, is what veterinarians can do to help people see that we're really on your side. This is not supposed to be an adversarial relationship.
Kate?
Yeah, and I think that one way I focus on that with the students is social media and how vet students can use social media to advocate and to share with the public a little bit more what it means to be a veterinarian and what the community of vet med really is. And so kind of helping with some of that society shift with the human-animal bond and communicating that through social media and also community outreach can be another way to open that up for the public.
Dr. Moses, I'm thinking there are probably a lot more pet owners who are listening to this conversation than vets. So how do you want the pet owners out there who are listening to think about this as they're thinking about their interactions with the people who are providing medical care to their animals?
Well, one of the things that I know in the course of my own clinical work, and by the way, my clinical practice is entirely in palliative care and pain medicine. So the only people who come and see me with their beloved animals are people who are really, really upset and worried about their animal suffering or maybe even end of life. So I talk about this stuff all day long in my exam room. And what I want people to understand is veterinarians are generally people who have picked the profession they're in because they care deeply about animals and they also care about people. We found that absolutely in the study that veterinarians feel really beholden and really care about the clients that they work with. I want people to know that, and I want people to know that because of the kind of people we are, we come with our own moral compass, and we come with our own opinions about what's right and what's wrong. And we want to work with you. We want this to be a collaborative relationship so that we can work together to figure out what's in everybody's best interest, particularly putting our patient, that animal that you love, in the center of that equation.
That's Dr. Lisa Moses, a vet, as she said, in pain and palliative care at the Angel Animal Medical Center in Boston. She's also on staff at Harvard Medical School, where she is a research fellow in bioethics. And I want to thank Kate Hamilton for being with us as well. Based here in Urbana at the University of Illinois College of Vet Medicine. Kate, Dr. Moses, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, well, thank you.
Thank you so much.
That does it for us today. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to be talking about movies for Halloween. Did you know that the movie Halloween might have taken place right here in Illinois? I did not know that because I do not like scary movies. They scare me, but I'm sure there are a lot of people out there who are not like me, and we want to hear from you. We want to hear what your spooky favorite is, what your favorite is that you bring out this time of year. If you're looking forward to seeing something in the theater, leave us a voicemail, and we're going to play it on the air tomorrow. 217-300-2121. Again, our hotline number is 217-300-2121. Let us know what your favorite scary movie is. I mentioned our website a couple of times during the hour. That's a great resource for things we've been talking about during the show. Also, ways to follow us on social media if you want to find our Twitter handle or link to our Facebook page. If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email. Just remember our website, 21stshow.org. We've also got lots of election coverage up there as well as voter guides. So if you just click on 21stshow.org and look over to the left, you'll see our voter guide, and you can also click to all of our election coverage. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a good day, and I'll see you back here tomorrow.